Okay. I know you typically want to do something pretty quickly.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
He's getting ready to do the transfer, I just have to say that.
I know all about that.
You don't have to pick one.
I did. Well, good evening. We are in lesson 12 this evening. We're talking about the book of Job, and we're going to be looking at the very end, the last section of Job, the Lord's second speech or challenge to Job. Before we actually get into our study of the text, I want to remind you, the members of this congregation, that if you have not signed up to indicate what adult class you want to be in the next session, which begins next Wednesday, please do that. In this auditorium, Judges and Ruth are going to be taught. Gary Copeland and Ian Boyke are going to teach those lessons. And then in the second adult class, Mike Eisen and I are going to be repeating a study that we did early this year on Roman Catholicism. There were a number of people who couldn't get into that class because of the size of the classroom the first time, so we're repeating the study. And then, of course, the young people likewise will be studying 1 Corinthians in their class. So many of you have already signed up, but if you haven't, please think about doing that so that teachers can prepare the right amount of material, get the material to those who are in the class. All right. On Sunday, our last lesson in Job is going to be a comprehensive review. And the way we're going to do that is, as we have done some in the past, we'll do a crossword puzzle that will kind of bring out facts that we've studied in the book of Job, the speeches, etc. And so hopefully that'll be a good way to review. So this evening, we're going to finish up the text. And as we have done in the past, I wanted to show you of the different divisions of the book, particularly in terms of dialogue, we're at the very end. And of course, God has two speeches, so to speak. If you go to Job chapter 40, go to chapter 40. God's speeches begin in 38. Elihu ends in 37. God's speeches begin in 38. And here is the end of the first one. Let's go back all the way to 38 and pick up the introduction to God's speech, which we talked about, his first speech, which we talked about in the last class. And he speaks out of a whirlwind, I think in symbolic of power, God's power. Verse 2, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Remember that sentence, because when Job speaks at the end of the second speech of God, he's going to quote that sentence. Dress for action like a man. Literally in the Hebrew, it's gird up your loins, the idea of being ready for action. I will question you, and you make it known to me. And of course, as you're well aware, then God peppers Job with question after question about both the animate world and animate creatures. And then in verse 1 of chapter 40, at the end of the speech, God says, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. And Job's response to the first speech of God is, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. So Job has been asking for the opportunity throughout the dialogue with the friends for the opportunity to speak to God, to present his case before God. He's confident that if he has the opportunity to make his case for his own righteousness, that God will come around. God will pronounce him righteous. Well, he has the opportunity. He doesn't have too much to say. So we begin this evening with the second speech, which actually doesn't begin promptly at chapter 40. It begins in verse 6, and then we'll run through chapter 41. 42 is essentially the epilogue. God is going to deal with the three friends, and he will also, we also learn what happens to Job after all of this takes place. So that's kind of wrapping up the text there. A couple of objectives this evening. I want to talk to you about the overall purpose of God's speeches. I think there was a pretty good quote that I included by Gibson in his commentary on Job in the lesson 11. And I'm going to bring that quote back up so that we can use it to summarize both of the speeches of Job, of God rather. And then secondly, why is it that God treats the friends and Job differently? In fact, he seems to commend Job, even though we've noted that Job has a number of rash things to say. He will repent, he says, at the end of the second speech. And the friends have been, basically defending God's justice and his power. And so we want to see if we can't understand why the difference in reaction to the three friends and Job. Hopefully we get to that point. So let's get started with question number one here. Of what did God accuse Job in chapter 40 and verse 8? Well, here's the verse. Will you, this is God speaking, will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? And I've said before that if the friends theory about the source of suffering, the reason for human suffering, if it's true, if personal sin leads to suffering and in proportion to it, then if Job is suffering and Job claims that he's righteous, what's the only other alternative? It is that God's being unfair, that he's not following this rule of righteousness brings prosperity and blessings. Wickedness brings the judgment of God. And so God says, will you even put me in the wrong? Has Job questioned the righteous? Okay, I got in an extra 6 minutes. And I'm not apologetic. Did Job ever question the righteousness of God, the justice of God? Oh, absolutely. In fact, we're going to look at a few representative passages here. Job is affirming his own righteousness. And if Job is righteous and the friend's theory is right, then the only alternative is that God's the one who's in the wrong. And Job basically implies that God's not just, that he's missed it this time. One of the passages that I hope you will remember is Job 9, 21 through 24. I'm probably not going to read all of these passages on the next couple slides. We've got some more passages. Just want to remind you of some of the things that Job has said in the various speeches as he's replying to his friends. Job 9, verse 21. I am blameless, he says. I regard not myself. I loathe my life. It is all one. Therefore I say, he means God, destroys both the blameless and the wicked. So Job is basically saying, God doesn't care whether you're wicked or blameless. He destroys both of them. When disaster brings sudden death, he, God, mocks at the calamity of the innocent. God's not sympathetic with their suffering. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He, God, covers the faces of the judges. And Job ends, if it is not he, who then is it? Because Job and his friends are all, at least in the beginning, assuming that suffering always comes from God, that God's responsible for all of this. Some other passages. Job 16, 11, I gave you 7 through 14, I think, in that list. God gives me up to the ungodly, Job says, and casts me into the hands of the wicked. Chapter 19, verses 6 and 7. Know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Behold, I cry out violence, but I'm not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. Now, there was a comment made a few classes ago that if you check the New King James Version against the ESV, particularly in this passage, I think it's verse 6 of Job 19, that the New King James Version kind of doesn't imply so much that God has done something wrong, or that God has placed Job in a net. Okay, if you want to argue about one verse or the other, but it's very difficult to argue against the repeated comments of Job that seem very clearly to indicate that he thinks God has not been fair with him. In chapter 24, I said I wasn't going to read all this, but if you'll pardon me, I'm going to read some of this. Why are not times of judgment kept by the Almighty? In other words, why doesn't God just bring justice here in this world immediately? And why do those who know Him never see His days? Some move landmarks. They seize flocks and pasture them. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless. They take the widow's ox for a pledge. They thrust the poor off the road, the poor of the earth. All hide themselves. So here's the wicked taking advantage of the helpless. Behold, like wild donkeys in the desert, the poor go out into their toil seeking game. The wasteland yields food for their children. They gather their fodder in the field and they glean the vineyard of the wicked man. Well, what's God doing about all this? Why is it, he says, that those who know him, who are righteous, why don't they see his days? Why don't they see the judgment of God against people who are taking advantage of the poor and the helpless, those who are suffering calamity? He goes on to describe the suffering of innocent people, which is kind of the other side of the coin, right? The wicked prosper and sometimes the innocent suffer. That doesn't fit the theology or the theodicy of the three friends. And in the beginning, Job as well. Look at Job 33, verse 8. Who's speaking here? Who's speaking in chapter 33? Good, Elihu. Elihu begins in 32, and he's uninterrupted until the end of 37. So this is Elihu speaking. Surely you've spoken in my ears, and I've heard the sound of your words. So now he's going to quote Job. You say, I'm pure without transgression. I'm clean and there's no iniquity in me. Behold, he finds occasions against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and watches all my paths. Behold, in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Now, Elihu is quoting Job's, not actual words, but certainly the thoughts that he presented. And he's being critical of Job. You say that God's wronging you. You're not right. Either Job is guilty or God is unfair, according to the thinking of the friends. Any comments or questions about this? I think that's why God says what he says in chapter 40 and verse 8. Would you put me in the wrong? Because when Job had to choose to defend his own righteousness or to declare God unfair, which does he choose? Well, he declares his own righteousness, and that implies that God must be unfair. Okay? I think I said that wrong, but hopefully you understood what I meant. All right, question number two. What challenge did God issue to Job in verses 9 through 13 of chapter 40? Well, if you look at those verses, let's just read them very quickly. It's not too many of them. Have you an arm like God? The Lord asks Job, and can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then will I acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. So what's God saying? All right, muscle up, Job. You complain that there's unrighteousness in the world. Let's see you do something about it. Well, what's Job going to do about it? Well, he's unable to. And I think that's the very point that God is trying to make. It's interesting that in God's two speeches, this is the last paragraph up there, in God's two speeches, there's very little said about justice. This is one of the places where God makes a connection between the various other questions that he's going to ask Job about the world around him and the animals that he's created, God's created. And he makes a connection here to justice. But that's really the point of a lot of this, right? that Job's unable not just to understand the world, the physical world around him, animate and inanimate, but that he is powerless to do what God can do. He doesn't know all the facts of the case. I want you to take a look at Job 38. This is in God's first speech. Remember, he speaks in 38 through 41. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? That's vivid, isn't it? Do you know how to control light so that you can shine light on the wicked, show them for what they are? It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked, their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. Can you do that, Job? There's another reference to justice. And Job is inadequate in knowledge and power. He can't even understand God's ways in the animate world, in the created world, much less in the matter of moral justice. All right, comments or questions, anybody? I'm going to share with you a quote a little bit later on about the overall purpose of God's speeches. His speeches are not to answer Job's questions. His speeches are designed to tell Job something by the various questions that he asks. And we've suggested some of that. We'll see if we can't nail that down in a rather concrete way a little bit later on. What animals did God cite in chapters 40 and 41? Cited a couple of animals that were the names of which we're pretty familiar with. They're going to be in the crossword puzzle. You know it, don't you? So what's the first one? Chapter 40. Yeah, behemoth. Behemoth. And then the second one in chapter 41. Yeah, Leviathan is the way I pronounce it. That may not be the correct way to pronounce it. you know, it's interesting sometimes to just kind of scan a bunch of commentaries to see what they have to say about who these animals are. And some of the attempts to identify behemoth or Leviathan are pretty pathetic. They've got the hippo, they've got the elephant, the alligator or the crocodile, and none of those descriptions really fit what this text is describing. Maybe these are mythical creatures, you think? Okay, I see some vigorous no's. What would be the impact on God's argument to Job, his point to Job, if these are in fact mythical creatures that don't exist? Because what is God asking Job about these animals in general? Yeah, can you control them? The one that the passage that I really enjoy is chapter 41. Begin in verse 2. Talking about Leviathan. Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you, an agreement with you to take him for your servant forever? You got me, Job. I'm your servant forever. You know, he'll make an agreement, Leviathan will. Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you put him on a leash for your maidens, is the New King James Version, for your girls, your daughters, your maidservants? Will he goes on. But he's basically saying, are you going to be able to control him? Will he submit to all of that? Same thing with behemoth. And so these are creatures that God has created. He says that about both of them. He doesn't present them as mythical creatures. But he says they're creatures that he has created. And Job is unable to control those creatures. God can, but Job cannot. Yes, Gary?
Yeah, like I says in 40:15, look now at the behemoth which I made along with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not mythical.
Yeah.
Conversation with a real man about another real thing he created.
Yeah. And if God's argument is, Job, I want you to see how little you are, then a mythical creature would not make the argument. But if God's talking about literal creatures that are so powerful that Job cannot control them, in fact, I think the suggestion is basically mankind cannot, then that says something to Job about who he is with respect to God, because as Gary pointed out in 40:15, I created him as I made you. Yeah, Robert? Yeah, or the argument wouldn't make much sense to him anyway. Yeah, that's a good point. He must have known something about these animals. Well, in the on the slide there, I don't think the animals were mythical. I think those descriptions do seem to fit some of the dinosaurs. Everybody knows dinosaurs were mythical, right? You know, that frustrates me when atheists or unbelievers will paint us as being the kind of people who would say, no, they're there, Sally. You don't have to believe in dinosaurs, as though that's some sort of Christian myth. We understand there were dinosaurs. We also understand that they existed at the same time that man did, and there's good archaeological evidence for that. And I suspect that Behemoth and Leviathan are descriptions of some of the larger dinosaurs. And of course, without getting into all kinds of specifics, that's unnecessary. I just think we're talking about actual literal creatures, some of whom were much bigger than even the creatures that we have today that are still extant in our world. God referenced these creatures so that he could compare their power to Job's power. What's he trying to tell Job? You've got a long ways to go before you're on par with me, even in terms of strength, much less moral justice. All right, comments or questions, anybody? Okay, all right, let's go on then. Question number 4, did God in his speech explain to Job why he was suffering? Well, that's what Job wants, isn't it? Job wants to know, why am I suffering? Job starts with the premise that he's righteous, that he hadn't done anything to merit all this suffering. Was that true? Was he a righteous person? Oh, absolutely. God commends him in chapter 1 and chapter 2 in the conversation, the dialogue with Satan. So that's not just Job, you know, bragging about himself. It was true that he was a righteous person. And he wants to know why God's suffering, causing him to suffer. But does God answer that question? Did God not know the question? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, if he doesn't answer that question, why not? Well, this is the quotation that I wanted to share with you. This, incidentally, is from Gibson's commentary. I think it's a pretty good summary of what's going on here in chapters 38 through 41, God's speeches. He writes, the purpose of his revelation, and he's speaking specifically about these speeches, is to discipline the heart rather than to satisfy the intellect. And this purpose, the manifestation here granted to Job, completely fulfills. All through Job's speeches, there had been visible a sense of injustice on the part of God. When he says visible, I think he means Job gave that intimation that God's really been unfair with me. It is to rebuke this and to bring him back to a right frame of mind towards God that the revelation is made. God's speeches. Job had not failed under the trial imposed upon him. He had never bidden farewell to God as Satan had suggested that he would do. I want to be very clear about this. I think it is erroneous to say that Job never sinned. I don't know how you can say that. It seems like you're struggling. There's a comment made at the end of chapter 2, and all of this, Job did not sin with his tongue, with his mouth. Sure, by the end of chapter 2, he hadn't. But then when you get into the dialogue with the friends, oh, he says some things that he shouldn't have said. He challenges the very character of God, his justice. But that's different than saying that he ended up succumbing to the temptation that Satan said he would fall prey to. What did Satan say in the beginning? Chapter 1. Yeah, he said, the only reason God serves, or that Job serves you, God, is because you built a hedge around him. You bribed him. You gave him all kinds of prosperity. And so, I mean, why not? Why not serve the God who's giving you all these good things? Take away his things, and as Gary said, he'll curse you to your face. Well, all of his possessions gone, his children killed. And Job doesn't do that. Job says, the Lord gave, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So God and Satan have another conversation in chapter 2. And what's Satan's argument in chapter 2?
You haven't hurt him physically.
Yeah, he doesn't care about all of that. That's just stuff. Even his children, that's not Job. Touch Job, make him suffer personally, and he'll curse you to your face. Job doesn't do that either. His wife actually encourages him to do that, and he says, you speak as one of the foolish women. Okay? So in all that takes place in the dialogue with the friends and everything that Job says is beginning monologue there and or soliloquy in chapter 3, Job never says, you know, I'm done with God. In fact, you can see glimpses in Job's speeches of a trust in God, even though Job doesn't really understand why all this is happening to him. And he still thinks that God's responsible for what's happening to him, and he still thinks it's not fair. But Job's the one who says, when I'm tested by God, I'll come out forth like gold. So Job is clinging to his relationship with God, even though there are some doubts. You think Job doubted at times? Doubted the fairness of what God was doing? Oh, absolutely. We read some just a few moments ago. But he never says, I'm done with God. Now, people do that. Have you known somebody who's had some sort of terrible calamity happened in their life, maybe lose physical things or financial losses, or the death of a loved one? And those people say, well, if that's the kind of God this world is ruled by, I don't care about that God. Or they'll say, I don't think there is a God, because if there was a good God, he wouldn't let that happen to me. Job doesn't do that, although Satan said, that's what he'll do, God, if you take away the bribe. You hurt him, and he'll leave you. So, Gibson said it so much faster. He had never bidden farewell to God as Satan had suggested that he would do. Moreover, as compared with the friends, he had spoken that which was right of God. Now, that seems a little awkward in light of some of the things we've looked at that Job said. So that statement that God makes there in chapter 40, verse 8, or 42 and 8, has to be qualified in some way, and we will. We'll talk about that. Hopefully the bell will save me. He had been true to facts. The friends, by their theory of retributive, what's the correct way to say that? Justice had dishonored the divine administration. And Job, by holding up the inequalities and perplexities of life, had at least kept free from false and unfair inferences as regards others. But all the same, he has said many blameworthy things, and to this point, the answer, speaking of God's answer, is directed. Now, Gibson continues, the speculative question of the purpose of suffering is nowhere dealt with or even touched upon. He's speaking of in God's two speeches here. But the condemnation and the friends in the epilogue give the divine verdict in Job's favor on this issue. The speeches of the Almighty are directed to another point, that is, to that attitude of soreness and feeling of injustice, which can never be justified unless the whole case is known. What's Job's problem in all of this? Yeah, go ahead, Robert. Well, he thinks he understands. He thinks God's doing this to him. Job's problem is he doesn't know what went on in chapters 1 and 2. We do. And so we look at that and say, hey, Job, you're mistaken. This isn't God doing this to you. Satan's the one. Now, God permitted it, right? In chapter 42, all the things that God had done to him. He did it actually indirectly through Satan. Satan's the one that does these things to him. But Job doesn't know that. As far as he's concerned, this is God doing this, and it just doesn't seem fair. So he doesn't know the whole case. So the point of God's speeches is to address that attitude of soreness and feeling of injustice, which can never be justified unless the whole case is known. Job doesn't know it. And by means of this wonderful panorama of creation that God brings out, there is brought home to Job the conviction that the whole case is not known. It's an implied argument. God doesn't say to Job, well, you know, Job, about this business of suffering, there's just some stuff you don't know. But what he does is he says, Job, I'm the one that created this world. Where were you when I laid the foundation? Where were you when I did this or when I did that? What do you know about this creature or that creature that I've created? And what is he saying to Job? Job, your knowledge isn't this, it's this. And that's the answer to this whole business of, well, why am I suffering? What's going on here? I need to know everything. God doesn't give him the information. He just basically says, you don't know. He therefore feels that he was wrong, Job this is, was wrong in his charges against God, and the vision finally brings home to him the sense of personal sin. Job's not suffering because of sins that he committed before all of this began. But he certainly has sinned since it began in some of the things that he says. Well, I don't want to spend too much time on this any longer so that we can get to the rest of the questions. But does that help you with some idea of what God's trying to accomplish here? Maybe there's a question in your mind. Why didn't God tell Job? It would have been so simple. It would have been so easy. God knows the answer to Job's question. He's the one that spoke with Satan. He could have said, it wasn't me, Job. It was Satan. He did this to you. Why not just tell him? I think it's because there's something more important here than whether Job gets the information and knows all the information about the whole case, as Gibson says, the whole case. God basically leaves Job with no other option than to trust in God. You may not understand how this is working. It may not seem fair to you. But Job, you're just going to have to trust God. I'm more powerful. You don't understand even the physical world. You're just going to have to trust me. And I'll be honest with you. I think that's a better, more important lesson than if God had said, okay, Job, here's the deal. This is the reason you're suffering right here. What he's doing to Job is he's saying, I want you to trust me to do the right thing, to be holy and just. Who else? Somebody else had their hand up as well. Okay, Ralph, let's start with you, Patrick.
God is in control. I don't need to worry about about why am I suffering because God is in control.
Yeah, and back to chapter 1 and 2, God says some really stupendous things about Job. But Job is tested to a much greater degree through this suffering. And it gets harder to trust God. It's easy to trust God when everything's going okay. When all the dominoes are falling the way they should, it's easy for us to say, yeah, I believe in God. I trust in God because, you know, He takes care of me. And then when things happen and they don't seem like, you know, everything's falling the right way, that's when that trust in God's really tested. And Job, I think, comes out of all of this with a stronger faith. Yes, Ralph.
If you ever explain something to a child, and then the child doesn't really understand it fully, they say, but why? And then you explain that, and they go, but why? Sometimes an explanation leads to another question, where the humbling of Job with the ultimate power of God humbles him to the point where he just says, what you said, I trust you.
At the end of the book, does Job finally discover why he's been suffering? Does he know? God leaves him with the question, but with the affirmation, you need to trust me. I know more. I'm competent to take care of this world. You don't know. Okay, let me get to Gary. If you can make a quick comment.
I have a question based on
that. Okay, let me get to Gary.
Maybe real obvious application for us, because we will probably never know exactly why in every case
we're
suffering. And we just gotta deal with that trust issue and just not be able to know. I think it's sad kind of to me that in modern times, a lot of proclaimed Christians say, oh, I'm suffering because God's got some great plan behind all of this. And so they still kind of say that God's doing this to me.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's cool.
A misapplication, I believe, of Romans 8.
Yes.
All things work together for good. And, you know, that passage is used to talk about suffering, calamity, catastrophe, death, everything. And I think that passage is talking about the stuff of chapter 8. But that's a whole different class period. Patrick? I believe, Patrick, that at the end of the book, Job still holds this idea that God's the one who's doing all this. I don't see any indication, either in Job's words or correction by God, that that's not the case. So what Job has to do is basically accept the fact that he doesn't understand what's going on here, but he knows God is God. God is just. We talked about that in the last class, I'm assuming you were here, that Job speaks out of both sides of his mouth. In one case, he says, God's unjust, he's doing this to me, you know, he's putting me in the wrong, he's the one that's being unfair. And then the next, you know, sometimes almost in the same speech, he'll say, but if I had a chance to talk to God, he would see this unfairness and he would make it right. That's a comment about the justice, the righteousness of God. So which is it, Job? Well, he's doing exactly what people do when they're emotionally distraught. Sometimes they say things that they're not thinking through, that they're not always totally logical, is I guess maybe a way of saying that. Okay. I think this last slide here, just as in his first discourse, God did not explain to Job in his second discourse why he is suffering, Job summarized God's point at the end of the second discourse. I know that you can do all things. Bing! That's the point. That's what God's trying to get Job to understand. I'm in control. You don't understand it, but I am in control. And so the book of Job's not really, I think, about an explanation of innocent human suffering. Job's suffering is the occasion for the lesson that we need to trust in God, even when we don't understand why certain things are happening in this world. We just don't have all the facts. We don't know the whole case. We don't know all the ways that God is working in this world. And for us to try to decide that we're going to you know, stitch out what God's doing here, and we know the... Can you control Behemoth? Can you control Leviathan? No. Yeah. Last comment on this.
It's interesting to me, if you go through this book and we're getting down to the end, there's obvious signs that Job sinned. He did some things wrong. But you notice his suffering did not increase. He didn't ever seem to pick up on the fact that all the suffering that he's doing, what he had happened in the first two chapters.
Yeah.
But then the next 38 chapters, he's still in the same boat other than his non-helpful friends. He's still suffering how he was, and it hasn't changed even though he has committed some sins along the way.
Yeah. Interesting observation. I don't think Job really picked up on that, as you noted. David?
Something that Job never understood, never was told, but we see the curtain open and we see God glorified by Job's suffering. And that's one thing that we can take, that we can rejoice in even when we are suffering, is that if we're faithful, that he's glorified. We don't understand why and what's going on.
I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, the whole point of this is in chapters 1 and 2 when Satan says, Job won't worship you, God, unless you bribe him. That's an attack against God, who God is and whether he's worthy to be worshiped and glorified. And Job, your point is well made, Job answers that charge by not saying, I'm cutting loose from God. I'm cursing God. Saying goodbye to God. That's the literal idea of cursing. Farewell. He stays with God. And in so doing, even though he says some things that are rash, in so doing, I think you're right. He glorifies God by showing Satan that man will serve God even if he's not bribed. I think that's an excellent point. All right, question 5 here. Got a couple more questions. Of what did Job repent in chapter 42 and verse 6. Well, take a look there. in chapter 42, verse 1, Job begins his answer to the second speech. I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? You remember? That was what God asked Job. Now Job is quoting that, and he says, therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand. That would be me. That would be me, Job says. I said things that I didn't understand, that I didn't know about. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear and I will speak, I will question you, and you make it known to me. Who's he quoting? He's quoting God again. God said, I got some questions for you. I'll speak. You answer these questions. I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. So what is he repenting of? Well, I think, as the bottom paragraph there on the slide says, I think he repented of his attitude in questioning God's justice. I don't think he was repenting of any sin that was, quote, responsible for the suffering that he endured, not something earlier than chapter 1 or 2. Job spoke of his eye seeing God, but did Job actually see God? You remember when the first speech starts? What does it say? Then the Lord spoke to Job out of a whirlwind. So what is Job saying? I see you. I understand now. And what he sees is that God is way above him and doesn't owe him an explanation of what's going on. All right, question 6. Why was the Lord's anger aroused against the three friends? This is, of course, part of the epilogue. And if you look down in verse 7 of chapter 42. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite. Why do you think he spoke to Eliphaz? Eliphaz wasn't the only one of the friends who spoke. There were three friends there, and Elihu. Elihu's not even mentioned. We'll say something about that just a little bit later. But why speak to Eliphaz? Any ideas? Okay, you started it. Eliphaz started it. Why do you think Eliphaz spoke first? The answer to that question is, why do you think Elihu spoke last? Age, yeah. Elihu says, you know, I'm younger than you guys, and I've been waiting to say some things, but I was hoping that I'd hear wisdom from you. Didn't happen. I'm quoting from the New Living Translation right now. Always a paragon of translational accuracy. So I think Eliphaz probably was the oldest. That's probably why he spoke first. And God's just using him as a representative. He's not suggesting that Bildad and Zophar are free from any kind of problem. And that becomes clear as he says, my anger, the Lord says, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you've not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Well, wait a second. The friend said some things that were right about God, and Job said some things that were wrong about God. So that statement of the Lord has to be qualified in some way. Of course, then the instructions are, verse 8, now therefore take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly. For you've not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Anytime the Bible says something twice, probably need to pay attention, okay? So God's emphasizing that something is different in these two groups, Job and the three friends. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did what the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. What does that sentence say? Well, it literally says that the Lord accepted Job's prayer. It says that Job prayed for them. Would you have prayed for these guys?
If the Lord told me to, yeah.
If the Lord told me to. Fair enough, David. I wouldn't question you. I think you would, Craig.
Just further testifying to his faith.
And to his character.
Done that, would have been disobeying God.
Yeah, yeah. And I think to his character. There doesn't seem to be any indication of a reluctance to pray on the behalf of Eliphaz, who said, you're getting what you deserve. And then Bildad, who says, if your children died, it was because they deserved it. And then Zophar, who said, you know, Job, you're not suffering nearly as much as you probably should. If only God would speak up and tell you the way you really should suffer. Those are the friends. And yet Job prays for them. You remember Job said, oh, that someone would stand between me and God if I just had a mediator. What's Job doing here? Well, he's acting as a mediator, an intercessor, essentially, on behalf of the friends. I heard the first buzzer. That was the first one, right? Oh, that was the second one? Okay, how many of you heard the first buzzer? Okay. I was fixing to call Steve a liar, but he's got witnesses, so we can't do that. Oh, my. Well, on Sunday, we will move out of the text briefly and then go right back in a crossword puzzle to talk about all of the text, or at least various parts of it, in our review. I hope you've enjoyed the textual study of Job. I hope you've got a good handle on what's going on in the book, what the point of the book is, what's happening to Job and why God has allowed all of this. I think it has some really relevant applications for us, because we may not suffer like Job, but at some point in your life, things are going to go bad, and we need to be prepared with the proper way to react to those occasions. All right. See you on Sunday.